failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the century of lies.
Welcome to this edition of Century of Lies. We'll be hearing several more voices from the Hartford Drug Convention. First up, Nicholas Isle, the editor of Reconsider magazine.
After decades of pursuing a policy that has not only failed in its stated goal of keeping us safe from drugs and crime, but has actually made drugs more available and us considerably less safe, Americans are at last seriously looking at alternatives. Wonderful to see this. These are precarious times for American cities. The recent hurricane that hit New Orleans brought to the surface that which America has tried hard to downplay. Its cities are chock full of poor folks, living in awful conditions, without jobs, seething with violence. I live in Syracuse, New York, a city similar in many ways to Hartford. It's similar in population, in racial breakdown. And being deeply involved in drug policy as I am, I talked to our city auditor a couple of years ago and suggested that he do an audit of the city police department and find out just how much money the city was spending on prohibition. So he did that, did a pretty thorough audit, released the information along with his professional opinion as to whether or not the money was well spent. This is the job of a city auditor. The audit discovered that 22% of the department's 28,800 arrests in a single year were for drug-related incidents, more arrests than for assaults, disturbances, and larcenies combined. Close to 2,000 persons were charged with possession or sale of marijuana. That's a drug that most experts will tell you, or at least many experts will tell you, is probably less harmful than alcohol. Lewis found that drug arrests were focused in six poor, heavily black inner-city neighborhoods. Police raids in search of evidence were rendering housing units, many government-owned, uninhabitable, and forcing families to split up because of government rules evicting drug users from public housing. If Syracuse's drug and arrest policy is intended to reduce drug use, the Lewis audit continued, I quote, it is not achieving its goal. The drug activity is continuing with an ever-increasing spiral of violence. He concluded that since drugs were at least as available as they ever were on the streets of Syracuse, since their purity was higher than ever, and since the crime rate associated with drugs, the violence, the stabbings, the shootings, all the rest, were increasing, this was not money well spent. And do something to make Connecticut a better place to raise your children. Stop wasting your scarce resources on this foolishness year after year. The same old stuff. It's up to you to hold up some of the truly innovative ideas you've heard about today and compare them to the desperate rehashing of old failed ideas we hear from the same folks year after year. You know that something that hasn't worked for 30 years is not going to suddenly start working again tomorrow when they try it again. You know what has to be done. So start reducing the harms instead of perpetuating them. Thank you.
Next, we hear from the outgoing president of Students for Sensible Drug Policy, SSDP.org, Ms. Scarlett Swerdlow.
I think that when we start a dialogue like the one that you're starting here in Hartford, youth need to be included and need to be brought to the table. The young people that I work with are very intelligent, mature people, and they're the type of people who are in student government right now, involved in other political organizations, and they're the type of people who are going to be making decisions about our drug laws and our drug policies and the way we approach drug use in the future. The step that you're taking right now is an amazing step, and I think that you really are ahead of the rest of the country. There's going to be many, many more years where we're figuring out, where we're, one, taking a step away from simply punitive laws and policies that just punish people. There's a very long time in between when we figure out what are ideal drug laws and drug policies. There's going to be kind of a period in between of experimentation where we figure out, you know, does this work, does this not work? what are, you know, what do we want to see as the outcome? Are we achieving that outcome? So to involve youth now, it's not just to get the perspective of youth, but it's to ensure that this challenge of discovering a better approach to drugs is actually fulfilled, because it is going to take time. You know, marijuana is illegal. And if you look at surveys, you know, young people will tell you, kids who are not in college will say, it's easier for me to get marijuana than it is for me to get alcohol. And why is that the case? Because to get marijuana, you need to go to a drug dealer. And a drug dealer doesn't care about the identification in your wallet. He doesn't care. She doesn't care how old you are. They care about the cash in your wallet. And so, you know, you're not going to have someone be carding young people who are asking for marijuana. And what that leads to is the fact that young people who are going to experiment with marijuana, which is the drug that most people are experimenting with, most young people are experimenting with, are going to be introduced to a whole black market, a whole criminal market of other substances, whether or not that's cocaine or heroin or ecstasy or a hallucinogenic. You know, by criminalizing marijuana, you're necessarily exposing a lot of young people. I think more than half of young people who leave high school have tried marijuana at least once. You're exposing them to a whole other criminal market. You know, a lot of the drug use that we see is just experimentation. And it doesn't go beyond that first try. And to punish someone for the rest of their life for that, I think, is very upsetting. And when I say punish people for the rest of their life, what I'm talking about is the fact that, you know, one issue that we deal a lot with is that if you have a drug conviction, you become ineligible for federal financial aid to go to college from anywhere for just a semester to indefinitely. And, you know, it doesn't matter how long ago you were convicted. It could be 1 year ago, it could be 20 years ago. You're losing your chance to go to college. That's a serious problem, and that someone has to live with for the rest of their life. Employment, a lot of employment opportunities are denied to people who have drug convictions. And in most states, people who have drug convictions or have any type of felony conviction are denied their right to vote. They're denied the right to participate in the political process at its most basic, fundamental level, and to really advocate for the laws and policies that they want to see changed based on their own experience. I think that as much as we can, we need to get young people involved and to engage them proactively and constructively and positively. And until we do that, I don't see our drug laws and our drug policies being very effective. And then the last thing, as I said before, is making sure we address obstacles to education and to employment that are put in place based if someone has made a mistake with drugs. And I guess kind of just to sum up, I would say that the things that I would like Hartford and any community that's thinking about taking a critical look at the way it deals with drugs to keep in mind is that, you know, young people need to be involved in this dialogue, not only for their benefit, but considering that this is going to be a challenge that's going to happen over time, it's to ensure that this challenge is fulfilled and that we meet it. So to involve them over the long term. And then also to really understand that, I think, as all of our experiences have been, the part of growing up is making mistakes and is learning. It's not necessarily something that ends at age 16 or 18 or 21, but that maybe we're making more mistakes when we're younger, or that that's definitely going to happen. And, you know, rather than punishing people for the rest of their lives for those mistakes, to allow them to go to school, to go to get a job, and to turn their lives around. So that's what I would ask you as you're moving forward. And again, thank you for having me here today.
Next, let's hear from Federal Judge Arthur Burnett.
It's an honor and a privilege to appear and talk with you this morning from a perspective of someone who has been involved in the law for 50 years. See, I started law school in September of 1955. I had 47 years at the bar, 33 years on the bench. I'll get back to the significance and relevancy of that very soon. But I want to first tell you about an organization that maybe you haven't heard too much about at this point. The National African American Drug Policy Coalition came into being April 1, perhaps April Fool Day, April 1, 2004, with 9 organizations signing a memorandum of understanding in the Rayburn House office building on Capitol Hill. Included among those 9 organizations at the time was the National Bar Association of all the African American lawyers and judges in the United States that chose to belong to that national organization, which was created when the American Bar Association would not let Negroes or coloreds become members of their bar. Also among that group was the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation, all the black members of Congress, the Black Sociologists for the entire nation, the National Organization of Black Psychologists, the National Black Nurses Association. And along about April or May of 2004, that group applied to Robert Wood Johnson Foundation for a grant, and Robert Wood Johnson said, well, who are you going to get to run the operation? And I was called by the president of the National Bar Association and a Dwayne Proctor from Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. I was sitting as a senior judge on the Superior Court of the District of Columbia, which is a trial court. Senior judge has the power to sit like a U.S. District Court judge for the rest of his or her life. And I was pretty much drafted, you might say, or called to the ministry of becoming the executive director of this organization. And the first responsibility of this organization was to kind of canvass the other black professional organizations out there who had a common interest in the problems of drug abuse in African American communities across this country, and developing a drug prevention program that would really work with our American youth. And so I set out on a task of becoming the catalyst or the proselytizer to reach out to other organizations with the goal of at least getting 15 national black professional organizations into this conglomerate or this confederation or this mini United Nations of black professional organizations. It came December of 2004, we reached the goal of 15 members, including bringing in the National Medical Association, the Black Psychiatrists of America, bringing in the Black Alcoholism and Addiction Council, and other organizations that had something to do with the problems of mental health, drug abuse, substance abuse, alcoholism. And we were about ready to incorporate as a D.C. corporation with tax-exempt status. But we had knocking on the door, about 8 other organizations. And so we put off incorporation. And by July of 2005, we had 23 National African American Professional Organizations, which included bringing in the National Organization of African Americans in Public Housing, the National Black Alliance on Education, or the Black Educators, the pharmacists, health systems, people that taught and teach in pharmacy schools. And as of July, we had 23 members, 23 organizations. We took an inventory of the memberships added up to 254,574 members nationwide and worldwide who say that the African American professional community wanted to help lead us out of the problems of the drug crisis in America. We now have 2 additional organizations that are talking about joining us, the National Black Pharmacists Association, or National Pharmacists Association, which is a black pharmacist who actually work in drugstores across this country, and the National Association of Health Systems Executives, which will bring the group to 25 such organizations. What is the mission? What is the goal of this organization? Number one is to push the envelope as far as it can go to make drug addiction in America a medical public health issue. 1962, the Supreme Court of the United States in California versus Robinson said that the status of drug abuse, or drug being a drug addict, cannot be punished as a criminal offense. We want to take that a step further and say simple possession to take care of that craving should not be punished as a crime. But we don't stop there. We have taken the position that those who sell drugs merely to get their own supply should not be punished, but should be referred for pretrial diversion and therapeutic sentencing rather than incarcerated in prison. The difficult issue, of course, is to define or draw the line between those who sell only to get their own supply and those who sell to poison other persons in order to profiteer, to get rich, or to enjoy the good life. But our philosophy is that we should decriminalize drug uses by the people who in fact have a drug problem and treat them in the public health medical model. We have teamed up with the National Association of Drug Court Professionals to hopefully over the next 3 to 5 years double the number of drug treatment courts in America. We're working as a team in joint venture with that organization to promote the development and expansion of drug courts as fast as we can convince politicians, legislative bodies to create and the judgeships necessary and provide the money to fund those drug courts. That's our number one mission. Our number two mission is to come up with a drug prevention program directed to our teenagers, which is not just a say no or a frightening approach of a DARE program, but in fact to couple a drug prevention program with a change the culture attitude of black and Latina youngsters to educational achievement by a system of rewards and incentives. We have created a program where if a kid stays in school and gets to the 8th grade and decides at that point he wants to be a doctor will be assigned to him in the 8th grade to be a counselor mentor from there, from the 8th grade all the way through med school. We're doing the same with the lawyers, with the architects, the engineers. Every one of our 23 organizations will inventory their membership throughout America and identify in every city every black professional who is willing to take on the obligation of taking an 8th grader by the hand and making sure they become a professional rather than a person in prison, an inmate. And then, when they get to be juniors and seniors in high school, we're going to put into place an internship program where they can go and work in the environment, in the field they want to go. They want to be a doctor, they work in a doctor's office. They want to be a lawyer, they work in a lawyer's office after school as part of the intern program. We want to give them positively an alternative to becoming involved in drug trafficking and in drug uses by saying we can give you a better life. We can open doors of opportunities for you. On November 14th, I have an appointment with the Deputy Director of the NIH to set up a mentors program for minority students in D.C. to get more minorities to go into science and math and the pre-med and after high school today to be able to go out to Bethesda and work with medical and scientific personnel to get more minorities into the field of science, math, and medicine. Only a week and a half ago, I entered a contract with the Marriott Hotel for our second summit next April 5 to April 8 in Washington, D.C. In working with the hotel manager of that hotel, they were sufficiently impressed with our mentor counseling program. They say, look, we want to work with you to establish a program for every student in D.C. who wants to go into hotel management, into finance, into economics, to work as a junior or senior in high school in hotel management at every Marriott Hotel in Washington, D.C. But it didn't stop there. They say that in addition, we will introduce you to the diversity manager for all of Marriott Hotels in America. And we will want you and we will work with them to establish a program like that for our youth across America, for all Marriott Hotels in this nation. So we are going to try to counter the culture of defeatism and frustration that leads many African-American boys to get involved in drug trade and drug trafficking. I was supposed to be talking to you today about where have all the young men gone? Well, that's a tough question, but let us look at a couple of points. I see our time is already running short. But at the point of youngsters going to high school, going to elementary school, those children who come in who look like they are bright and smart are targeted to potentially be members of drug gangs. And they don't see black male teachers in schools. Some of them don't see any black teachers, males, until they get to high school and then. And they are then coerced and forced to become members of drug gangs and to prove their loyalty to gangs to be stashes even when they wanted to be good kids. Many of them are raised by single mothers, mothers who sometimes have to work two jobs and not around at home to praise and to work with their youngsters to inspire. And over my career of 33 years on the bench, I've seen kids who have sometimes been coerced or forced into drug trade and drug trafficking even though they didn't want to be. And as a result, our current system creates and adds to the number of black boys who are, in fact, coerced into drug gangs merely for self-protection, to keep from being beaten up on the way to school two or three times a week. And then to prove their loyalty, they have to be involved in a stash and cut class, even though they don't want to. And by the time they get to the eighth grade or ninth grade, they then say, why should I continue in school? And we have 50% or more who enter the eighth grade who do not finish high school. Many of them, with single mothers who have boyfriends who shack up with them, are forced out of the house and kicked out of the house, where they have to fend on the streets. And therefore, the system, in fact, breeds criminality and brings more people into our criminal justice system. We have to deal with that problem and find a better way to inspire our young boys not to become, you might say, sucked into the system. In conclusion, let me just say the question is, we are establishing local coalition groups all over the United States in pilot programs in cities, but is this enough? What I've heard here led me to the point of this conclusion, and that is that as a judge who has seen these problems for 33 years, I'm going to have the courage to say it, that I join with Judge Schoenberg and suggest that we need to medicalize the problems of drugs in America and decriminalize them. Would we have a better America if, in fact, we had a system that regulated like Cliff described to you? I submit we need to have an honest press to tell American people what the real facts are and let the American people decide. And maybe you'll find that we'll have more Oaklands throughout America. I thank you.
Next, we hear from David Bicklin, who was for many years the executive director of the Connecticut Law Review.
Elected officials don't wish to admit that they have a problem in their own community. One of our recommendations was to allow a pilot program for physicians to prescribe methadone in their own offices. That was changed, again, by a high elected official to say, but it can't happen in my community, West Hartford. It can only happen in those, because, of course, we don't have opiate dependents in my community, West Hartford. Only in Hartford would we have that sort of thing. One of our suggestions was to let's relook at the medical marijuana laws. So there was a lot of testimony by folks who were using marijuana for medicinal purposes. Then the DEA agents started calling the legislative committees and demanding the names and addresses of those who testified, intentionally interfering with the legislative process attempting to gather information. A Yale research physician who was working inside the prison system testified regarding treatment services in the prison. He received a letter from the then commissioner of corrections saying, don't testify. If you do testify, you'll lose your funding. He testified. He lost his contract with the Connecticut prison system. This is institutional pressure, not simply public debate. Institutional pressure to keep folks from bringing these issues to the forefront. Folks simply don't want to appear soft on crime. But what I'd like to see in good drug policy, and I think most of the people in this room would be, we would reduce illegal drug use, reduce attendant criminal behavior, reduce risky health behavior, and it would improve health and other sorts of social functioning.
Okay, that wraps up our coverage from the Hartford Conference on Drugs. I hope you've enjoyed it. You can hear all of these shows by visiting our website at drugtruth.net. Poppygate, bizarre news about the U.S. policy on controlling heroin, featuring Glenn Greenway.
Dear listener, please remember that 9 of 10 syringes penetrating the main lines of heroin consumers everywhere are filled with the fruit of U.S.-occupied Afghanistan. Heroin trafficking is the engine of U.S. occupation and provides the majority of Afghan revenue. Afghan heroin production is now 27 times higher than in 2001 when the Bush administration toppled the oppressive Taliban government. U.S.-occupied Afghanistan is only one-third the size of Mexico, yet produces 6 times more marijuana and 45 times more heroin, according to recent UN data. Most remarkably, the amount of heroin traded on world black markets has increased sixfold since the U.S. slammed the pedal to the drug war metal in 1970. This is Glenn Greenway, reporting for the Drug Truth Network.
November 8, 1984. The international marijuana seizure record is set at 4,260,000 pounds in Mexico. This is Steve Nolan for the Drug Truth Network.
Don't forget, if you're a professional drug warrior, you can make $1,200 by coming on this program and clarifying the need for drug war. I would urge you to please visit our website, drugtruth.net, and listen to this week's Cultural Baggage program with Cliff Thornton. His speech at the Hartford Drug Convention is featured on that program, and he rips and shreds the drug war like never before. Be sure to join us next week on Cultural Baggage and Century of Lies. We'll be bringing you reports from the Drug Policy Alliance Conference in Long Beach. Once again, I state there is no truth, justice, logic, scientific fact, moral clarity, medical reason, no religious underpinnings, in fact, no reason whatsoever for this drug war to continue. We've been duped. The drug lords run both sides of this equation. Please do your part to help end this madness. Please visit our website, endprohibition.org. Prohibido esta quivalesco. For the Drug Truth Network, this is Dean Becker asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. The show produced at the Pacifica Studios of KPFT, Houston. Our engineer, Philip Duffy.